And under deliver. Stop. Think about it just a little. I mean, think about the moon. It's fucking huge. Can only hope you sort it out of storage room. And a manual too.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. If you are in Amory, Wisconsin, hello, Lake Air, WALK. Broadcasting all across the state, I'm joined by my producer extraordinaire, Anya Esther. Got a couple of big questions to kick off today. We're going to be hearing from Civic Media's own news director, Terry Bell. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk all things Kamala Harris, state of the state. Good stuff coming, because unfortunately, friend of the show and professor of sociology at Princeton, Catherine Eden, has come down with a nasty bit of food poisoning and can't join us this afternoon. So you join us, 844-967-2789. Anya, I've got some questions. I'm hoping you and others have some answers.
I don't know how I'd have answers, but I'm ready for the questions.
They're opinions. So everybody, you know, opinions are like elbows. Everybody's got at least a couple, right? Most of the time. So here's my question. Heaven help me, but I have no freaking idea why primaries, like, we're going to have two primaries that will probably total a number of voters south of 400,000. And that will, Trump will be the nominee. So 400,000 people have voted in Iowa and New Hampshire over the last week. A total number of votes that doesn't even equal the population of the city of Milwaukee. And that's going to determine the Republican nominee for president. Like, why does that make any sense? I don't understand it. Does it make any sense to you other than like, this is how we've always done it, so let's just keep doing that?
Yeah, that's it's in that exact tone that I think of it too. Well, we've always just sort of gone to Iowa and stood in a field, and then the men got to, got to determine who the next president was. It's like, I don't want to go to Iowa, though. I don't know why we're doing these things. And the fields, why are we doing it like this? It's not 1880, I don't think. Not in most parts of the country.
Yeah, and put slips of paper in paper bags, because that's
and wear our straw hats. I don't know what we're doing.
Can anybody justify this to me? I mean, what is your opinion out there, civic media folks? 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Talk or text. I don't get it. I am confused. I do not understand why it has been the case since 1972 that Iowa goes first. I don't understand why it is the case that since 1920, New Hampshire is next. No one lives in Iowa or New Hampshire. They don't. Iowa's not representative of, it's not like a bell curve of Republicans in Iowa. It's Iowan Republicans. Why is this a good idea? I just do not understand it. I'd like to know if, I'll give you multiple choice, right? A, we've got to do this differently. Duh. B, just leave it alone. It's the way we've always done it. Or C, let's fix this problem. I don't get it. CJ, my friend, you're a Republican. You're a routine Republican voter, I think. Tell me, does this make sense to you? I mean, if you were an Iowan, would you be like, yes, this is a good idea. This is how we should do it.
That's the way we've always done it, Maggie. I believe in tradition.
Like tradition for traditions.
Primary. Look at what it was, payoff to Senator Clyburn to move it to South Carolina. Boom. That's what we see. There's no, I guess, reverence for history on the Democrat Party. you will justify changes just because you think it's okay. You're going to try to cram the Supreme Court. Maggie, thank you so much for taking my call, because most hosts on Civic are afraid to take my call now.
Oh, I'm not. Let's just pause for a second. I want to ask you a couple of questions. So here's my standard for preserve the way we've done it or change things. Is it working? That's the way I view things. Is it working? Now, I think really good arguments can be had about, like, how do we evaluate if something's working, whether we're talking about the Supreme Court or the way that parties select their nominees when there's contested primaries. My question to you, just trying to focus in on the order of primaries as a first order question, does it make sense to you to go Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina? Or do you think we should be asking both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to take a good look at this and figure out if this really makes sense? Does this make sense to you these are good Democratic, this is a good Democratic way to engage a lot of people in a meaningful way to select presidential nominees?
Yes, very much. We had 13 candidates on the Republican side. They went there, they campaigned, and we're down to two. You know what? This is the way the Republicans want to choose their candidate. And your party, the Democrats, don't believe in that. They're afraid.
But I'm not asking you about the Democratic Party. I'm asking you, like, to tell me why, as a Republican, it makes sense to have, I just want to get the vote totals here, 110,000 people in Iowa, which is basically the lowest number they've seen in well over 15 years. Like, why is that a good process? It was only 15% of Iowa Republicans. Like, is it a good idea to pick your nominee when only 15% of Iowa Republicans showed up in caucus last Tuesday?
Well, part of it was that, look at the weather. I mean, that certainly was a factor. But yes, we are down to already two candidates in the Republican Party. This is the way.
Is that good?
And
is that good though, CJ?
Yeah,
like,
I love it, because you know why?
Forget that you're a fan of Trump. Just hang on. Forget that you're a fan of Trump. Let's just talk about getting people engaged in the process and trying to further engagement. That's a bit of one of my standards that I'll use to try to evaluate whether or not our primary processes work. When you have a contested primary for a presidential nomination.
My first choice isn't former President Trump. My first choice is Nikki Haley. But I tell you what, I'm voting Republican. So if it is Trump, I'm all in on Trump.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that. But we still haven't focused in on my question, which
is, what do you mean you're not surprised about that?
Well, because CJ, you've expressed
your surprise about that.
Because you've expressed a strong preference for Mr. Trump and the Trump presidency. I understand that you would prefer Ms. Haley as the candidate. Great, that's wonderful. But I would have expected you given the views that you've expressed on the show, that you would vote for whomever the GOP selects as its nominee. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, you know why?
I wasn't suggesting.
You know why I pick her? You know why I choose her?
Tell me.
She's got a great answer about the chaos, and she's got a great answer about abortion. That you want to claim, your party, not you, I'm sorry, I apologize. And thank you so much, Maggie, for taking my call. I get excited because I actually do enjoy your perspective. And Anya, even when she substitutes, I've never really talked to her or met her, but she sounds really cool.
Anya's fabulous. I totally agree.
She's got, here's the thing. Nikki Haley answered, and this is the thing. If women's health care is a huge thing for you, and I've evolved on the issue, I get it. But what I want to ask you, what are your restrictions? Is 14 weeks enough? If you've seen an ultrasound, 14 weeks should be enough, unless it's in the case of you know,
14 weeks is not enough. There's just no body of science to support a 14-week abortion ban. If you are a young woman, say someone who has just started menstruating, and you start to engage in sexual activity, or you're the victim of a sexual assault, oftentimes your periods are completely irregular. And that young person, and even women well into their 20s, have completely irregular periods. And they simply would not know by 14 weeks. I'm not the one that's making the policy, but I can tell you that outright abortion bans, criminalizing abortion, criminalizing women trying to make healthcare decisions in consultation with their doctors, their families, and faith leaders, isn't the right way to promote health overall.
Here's
what say you? I mean, what's your defense of a 14-week ban?
Most women know. 99% of women know.
What are you citing? What are you citing for that statistic?
12 weeks, and what? I've evolved on this. Okay, mine is that I've been hoping. I've seen an ultrasound at 14 weeks, so I know what that looks like.
So what?
And if a woman, if a woman chooses through, she should be able to. But there should be some restrictions. And you have a doctor on quite often, Dr. Riley, I believe her name is.
I've never had an OBGYN on my show. I've never had an OBGYN on my show. I'm gonna let you go just because we got a couple of other callers, CJ. I appreciate the question. You asked me why 14 weeks doesn't work. I told you, you cited a statistic. I asked for a source. Please email me, CJ, and give me the source that says 99% of women know that they're pregnant by 14 weeks, because I don't think that's true. Cindy from Appleton, you are on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you this afternoon?
Yeah, this coming from a man. Anyway, you know, we have not passed the ERA amendment yet. That's been over 100 years. We now have most gun laws in the United States that have taken us back into the 1800s. Why would you expect the Republicans to take any kind of their primary stuff out of the 1800s? These people want to remain back in the 1800s in the dark ages forever. And I don't understand why, but something to do with progress just doesn't sit well with them.
I hear you, Cindy. Again, I think I'm pretty middle of the road when it comes to change. We should change things if they're not working well. Now that we got to decide how we're going to measure it, how we're going to decide if something's successful. That's why I'm so interested. If you're a conservative, a traditional Republican voter, please give me a call or text me 844-967-2789, because I wouldn't like it if 100,000 people were picking the presidential nominee for my party when there's millions of Republicans out there. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Stick with us, folks. We'll be back with more in a minute. Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm pondering the imponderables this afternoon. I don't understand why it seems like, unless Nikki Haley pulls out an enormous upset in New Hampshire, that it's nearly certain, I'd say about 90% certain, that Donald Trump will be the nominee for the Republican Party in the 2024 presidential election. And let's just put this in context. There are 40 delegate votes available from Iowa. 1,215 votes of delegates are required to become the GOP nominee for president. Basically, that was like, it was over after Trump won 20 of 1,215 15 delegate votes. I would, if you are a conservative, you will go right to the front of the call line. I mean, honestly, I'd just like to have a discussion. If it was, there was a contested Democratic primary, I'd be trying to engage the same conversation with Democrats because we would still be starting in Iowa. And here's like, here's a little nerdy factoid about this primary process, which I still think is just bananas and makes no sense. And it's antiquarian. I don't think it works. Works for me here is it engages voters. It allows the vast majority of interested partisan primary voters or caucusers to be heard. In other words, it helps engage meaningful debate within a party about who should be their nominee. My opinion is this process doesn't do that. Because you've got all of this money. What DeSantis spent, what, like $6,000 a vote in Iowa? That's insane. It puts too much focus on the issues of Iowans and Granite Staters. Like, what if the law was you have four primary dates and a state has to do it on one of those four, so that you would have great volumes of states voting in primaries on one of four dates? Seems to me you would have a greater contest of ideas that speak to the vast majority of Americans, whether you're Democratic or Republican, that seem to be better than this process. All right, here's my little random factoid. Nevada. February 6th in Nevada is the Democratic primary, but February 8th in Nevada is the Republican caucus. Now, what? Like, this does not help people understand the process. I think the parties have far too much power, right? They anoint candidates. You were a Bernie supporter back in the day. This was a oft-heard complaint, not without merit. We shouldn't be anointing our nominees. We should allow voters, not party elites, through gamesmanship of these primary processes, to force the party elite's selection on everybody else. I think it's pretty crappy that in some states, including Iowa, there will be no Democratic primary. In fact, they're writing in Biden in New Hampshire. He doesn't appear on the ballot. What's the sense of that? You want to know why people are disengaged from politics? It's this kind of stuff. It doesn't pass the smell test, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here. And doing it the way that it's been done since 1972 in the case of Iowa and since 1920 in the case of New Hampshire isn't reason. Because we've always done it that way isn't a reason. It's often cited. Well, I guess it is a reason. It's just a bad reason. Does it work? Does it engage people? Does it allow candidates to join issues? Does it promote actual debate of issues? Or does it promote spending millions and millions of dollars to convince smaller and smaller slivers of voters? That I don't think is democratic, small d. Somebody can tell me differently. I would love to hear it. Mark from Prairie du Sac, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show. What say you?
Yeah, I can't tell you any difference. It's kind of a undemocratic, democratic system to select the candidates. I mean, and as far as tradition goes, that I'm all for changing tradition if it makes our government more functional, makes our society more functional. Hell, if we just stuck with tradition, we'd still have slavery in this country because, you know, traditionally, slavery has always been around, but I mean, it's led to the downfall of civilizations. The fact of the matter is, it's confusing to me how anybody can accept a man like Donald Trump to be their leading candidate, their preferred choice, when the man admitted to being a sexual assaulter when he says, "Just grab him by the
right."
And now he was, you know, that by an illegal proceeding, you know, by civil court, he was found, you know, for
He's a rapist. He's been legally concluded to be a rapist.
He's a rapist. And this is the guy they're sticking behind. This is the guy that CJ, Mr. Traditional,
Because everybody makes mistakes. There are mistakes and then there are mistakes. There are mistakes and then there are rape. There's the Al Franken sexual harassment, poor jokes and bad taste. And then there's rape, right? Again, this seems to me to be more sort of this doctrine of false equivalency and just a rejection of any nuance, right? Angel in Kenosha wants to know, doesn't every state vote in the primary? Yes, Angel, but when every other candidate drops out, when only one state has gone, there is no longer a viable or meaningful primary. We had one primary where 110,000 people voted, less than 15% of registered Iowa Republicans. And then candidates just started dropping like flies. I mean, Tim Scott dropped out before a single primary had run. Vivek Ramaswamy got beaten about the head, neck, and shoulders by Donald Trump and said, thank you, I'll have some more, please. He drops out, a day ahead of Iowa? Day after Iowa, Ron DeSantis, who's calling Donald Trump a threat to our democracy, is now bowing at the altar. I don't understand that. I don't think that that helps our democracy. So my point, Angel, and to others is, yeah, all the states are going to, quote unquote, vote in the primary, but no one shows up to vote in primaries if all the other candidates drop out. And here's the thing that scares me the most. Most pundits have said that for Nikki Haley to stick in this race and continue to spend the millions and millions and millions of dollars it will take for her to get to Super Tuesday. She's got to go through South Carolina, Nevada, Nevada first, then South Carolina, then Michigan, Idaho, Missouri, the District of Columbia, North Dakota, before she gets to Super Tuesday on March 5th. They said if she doesn't come out with a big upset and absolutely crush turnout in New Hampshire, she's effectively done. And after tonight, fewer Republicans will have voted than is the entire population of Milwaukee. I don't think it's a good way to pick a candidate. I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked. We're going to be joined by Civic Media's news director, Terry Bell, when we...
I don't like your little games. Don't like your tilted stage. The role you made me play. The fool. No, I don't like you. I don't like your perfect crime. How you laugh when you lie. You said the gun was mine. Isn't cool. No, I don't like you.
Maggie, you are muted, my dear.
Welcome, everybody. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join us this fine afternoon, 844-967-2789. Let me start with a mea culpa to my friend Angel in Kenosha. Apparently, in responding to this very legitimate question about aren't there actual primary votes in every single state, I sounded dismissive of the question. Not at all, Angel. It's a most excellent question. I'm so sorry if I offended or sounded if I was being dismissive. Not at all. Great question. And I wanted to sort of explain why and how I could be saying, you might sort of functionally have a primary that's over after one or two states have voted, even though all 50 states get to vote. So my apologies, my friend. Please keep listening and tell me if I say something that ticks you off, because at least I can try to make it right. So thanks for that feedback, Angel. Welcome, Terry Bell, Civic Media's news director. I've been wanting to have you on for quite some time. Thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here, Maggie.
So exciting. So much happening. You are very busy this week. Tell everybody what kicked off on Monday. We had the vice president in town.
The vice president was in Wisconsin in Waukesha County on the 51st anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision that legalized abortion, and until it was overturned a couple years ago by the Dobbs decision, and has since been thrown into a bit of chaos. The legal wrangling continues in Wisconsin, even though a Dane County judge has ruled that Wisconsin's 1849 law, which was widely interpreted as an abortion ban, ruled that it is in fact a ban on feticide and not elective abortion, and that'll ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. But I think that it just goes to show that of all the places the vice president could have been in the country on such a day, she chose Wisconsin. Even more telling that she chose Waukesha County. And I'm sure you've probably discussed this on your show, but Democrats feel they have an issue that they can cut into some of the Republican voter base with particularly suburban women, educated women, women who might be fiscally conservative in a lot of ways, but also support, you know, a women's individual autonomy over her body. So the polls certainly suggest that. There was some talk the vice president might be in Madison, but I think strategically they decided Waukesha County might be a bigger return on investment.
Yeah, it's certainly, I couldn't agree more with what you just said, that the choice of the location, not just Wisconsin, but Waukesha, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, speaks volumes to how critical small slivers of voters may be in a state like Wisconsin come the presidential general election. Again, back in 2020, we were talking about what a differential of some 20,000 votes. You start peeling off a few suburban women in Waukesha or in other parts of the state, college-educated women. But let's not narrow it to that, Terry. Mm-hmm. We were hearing from one of Civic Media's most loyal listeners and callers earlier today, CJ, expressing that his views on healthcare freedom have evolved. And he acknowledged in some way that, yes, there should be a right to choose. And he's more interested now in thinking about, well, how long should be abortion be permitted? I think using CJ as a bit of a foil for this broader discussion, yeah, people are really having a think about this. And I think not just college educated women, but men too, men that love women, men that are married to women, men that have female daughters, right? Hey, healthcare freedoms matter to all of us, right?
I had an occasion to cover a roundtable on reproductive rights on Sunday. And what really struck me was I think a lot of people, if they really knew the stories about some of the very difficult positions that women and girls and doctors and nurses are put in, because it's just not as black and white as, say, exceptions for the life of a mother. Sometimes you have to make predictions and you don't know how the predictions will play out, and you don't know legally where you stand. So, you know, the healthcare professional not only has to think about, you know, do no harm and do what's right by the patient, but they also have to, you know, be concerned about the, you know, getting in trouble with the law, being arrested and getting thrown in prison.
You know, one of the things that I've talked about frequently on my show is that what many predicted would happen if Roe was reversed has indeed happened. And that is sort of healthcare chaos. You're tipping your hat, as it were, to that point, Terry, in that women don't actually understand what the rules are. Apparently, we didn't understand what the 1859 law meant here in Wisconsin. A couple of Dane County judges had to tell us in two different opinions, and there's still disagreement about that. Healthcare professionals, there are bans that include exceptions for the life of the mother, don't clearly understand what triggers the life of the mother exception. How close to death does the mother need to get? And we've seen at least one woman from the state of Texas left because she was afraid she might die. And she was afraid that physicians and other medical providers in the state of Texas wouldn't help her. Like, how close to bleeding out, how close to septic do you have to get? And my argument frequently has been, when you start to look at a law that defies, especially when you're prohibiting a behavior, and you start to look at, well, how does this work out in practicum? And it becomes very evident that you can't legislate all of these detailed things that people actually need to know in order to follow the law. This might be an area of human conduct and human choice that we probably shouldn't be prohibiting because it's not particularly effective. Speaking of effectiveness, Terry, how did the crowd respond to the vice president's speech on Monday? How did, what was your overall appreciation of the effectiveness of her message and engagement?
Hard to say because these events are always populated by supporters. So, of course, the reaction will be very supportive. So it's very difficult for me to say. I just know that, you know, like I say, it's very difficult to say based on that.
Full house? Was it?
Well, I wasn't there personally. Stuart J. Waddles was our reporter there. He was our close
Waukesha news guy. Yep.
Exactly. So I love Stuart. He's a great guy. And he was there. He could probably better tell you about the read of the crowd and all that. I was with the president in North Milwaukee back in December. Yep. And yes, people are there by invitation. Their supporters, they're very excited to be there and very receptive to the message.
Well, let's flip a page and talk a little bit more locally. The governor's State of the State address will be coming up in just a few minutes here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're going to have coverage of that. Tell folks who's going to be giving us sort of the play-by-play, listening to the rebuttal from the Wisconsin State GOP, and who they can be listening for and to come 7 o'clock here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Well, thanks, Maggie. Yeah, this is a great opportunity to promote that broadcast. I will be anchoring the coverage along with Civic Media's Todd Aubaugh, host of the Todd Aubaugh Show. Todd, as many longtime listeners know, a longtime political insider, so he has terrific insights. He's been through many of these Capitol ceremonies and speeches and everything, so his insights will be terrific. I'll be anchoring the coverage from our studios in downtown Madison. And shortly after that, we will get the official Republican response. Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux has that responsibility this year.
I love it. I can sleep well tonight knowing that the Civic Media News Director, Terry Bell, knows how to pronounce Devin Lemieux's name. Not all of us.
My job.
Yes, not all of us have it down. Bravo. Folks, you're not going to want to miss that. Terry, incredibly encyclopedic knowledge. Todd, one of the guys that I enjoy listening to immeasurably here on the Civic Media Radio Network, brings a really interesting, again, insider perspective on the machinations, the goings-on, the things that you might not see if you're just reading the news. Todd's got great insight into. So everybody's going to want to keep it locked to listen to Tony Evers speak, then to listen to Senate Speaker Lemieux starting at the top of the hour. What are some of the things folks should be listening for when they stay on after my show concludes this evening in both Governor Evers' speech and in the rebuttal from Senator Lemieux?
Absolutely. Well, I expect the governor, State of the State speeches are a bit different during an election year. It's going to be a very short amount of time that lawmakers are going to be spending in Madison this year. Sessions wrap up early in election years. I've heard everywhere from late February to mid-March. So there's not a lot of time. So instead of talking about big picture policy initiatives, or I should say specific policy initiatives, say like last year, it was a budget year. So there are a lot of specifics for the governor to talk about and a lot of initiatives put through and a long amount of time ahead of them. It's going to be a short amount of time. So he's going to be talking more big picture, maybe setting the tone for the upcoming elections. We got a preview of the speech, and from the looks of things, if he's going to be talking about anything specifically policy-wise, nuts and bolts, it'll be how to address Wisconsin's workforce shortage. And, you know, any employer in Wisconsin can tell you it's really hard to find enough people to fill the openings that they have for their jobs. And the governor is going to put out a lot of mentions about things that Republicans have already been resistant to: paid family leave, investing more in public education, his long-term solutions to the childcare crisis. Republicans responded in kind mainly with tax cuts, and I don't see anything different happening for the rest of the session. In fact, Republicans came out with their latest tax cut proposal, a $2 billion tax cut, and you know, a lot of people would benefit from it, but so would a lot of people who are making well in a, into the six figures, which I think is not the target the governor has in mind. I think he's looking for more tax relief for people who are living check to check. So I don't know if there's going to be much of a budge there. I think Mr. Lemieux is going to be talking about things that Republicans have tried to get through that he's going to claim the governor has stood in the way of, mainly tax cuts. Another couple of things that have been coming up this week have been a redistricting bill that was voted on in the Senate today, and also a binding referendum, binding statewide referendum on abortion. Those sorts of bills are what cynics would maybe call veto bait. They're not going to pass. Everyone knows it, but they'll be able to take these issues to the campaign trail this summer and fall and say, I fought for this. Tony Evers stopped me.
Yeah, there's so much of that that goes on. And I think for folks that don't really engage on a day-to-day basis with politics, it's easy to take that bait, right? They bait the veto from the governor so that they can then assail the governor's veto when they know all along it's performative, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of the theatrics of politics. It's a bit unfortunate given that so many of these issues are really, truly almost at crisis levels for Wisconsinites. The child care crisis, it is probably the
biggest one. The biggest pressing need really is child care. I mean, it's a double whammy. It's too expensive for families, and the centers can't pay people enough to have good people stick around very long. So it's an industry in bad need of help, no matter what your solution may be.
Well, great minds think alike, Terry. I was going to pin those two together myself. They can't find enough people because we don't have enough folks ready and skilled to work those jobs, and we don't have the transportation to get them to the jobs, and it all costs too darn much when it comes to healthcare. My thanks to you. Hats off, Terry. Have great coverage of the state of the state. Everybody, keep it locked. You're going to hear from Civic Media's news director, Terry Bell, and Todd Alba, host of The Todd Alba Show. You could not be in better hands for some deep thinking about the governor's state of the state. Keep it locked. I've got some more deep thoughts for you coming up after this break on The Meg Fawn Show.
The Shaw, WAUK.
Please don't take my hand. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Please don't take him just because you can. Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green.
Jolene,
your smile is like a breath of spring.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. You're going to want to keep it locked because Terry Bell and Todd Alba are going to be taking you through Governor Evers' State of the State speech statewide on the Civic Media Radio Network immediately following my show. You're going to want to hear what they have to say to really smart guys that are going to break it down, including the GOP's response coming from Senator Lemieux immediately after the State of the State. Got a couple more texts coming in about the abortion question. Amy B., why are there any limits on abortion? Seriously, HIPAA folks, why is this not simply between a doctor and their patient? That is a perfectly reasonable policy approach. In other words, you don't regulate abortion directly. You place the standards of healthcare and the delivery of healthcare services on doctors and other healthcare professionals, and that's how it's addressed. In other words, you treat healthcare freedom as an essential freedom for every individual, and you don't treat this healthcare procedure any different than any other healthcare procedure. That is a perfectly reasonable approach. And it happens to be the way that we address healthcare procedures for men nearly universally. Why would that be equitable and fair in a democratic republic that values individual choice? Because if we're going to now start allowing religious beliefs to dictate the healthcare freedoms of others who may not share our religious beliefs, then the following should also be true. Men seeking vasectomies should not be permitted to do so if they are married and their wife is of childbearing age. Because sex is only for procreation, according to some religious beliefs. In addition, men could not receive Viagra or any medication for erectile dysfunction if they are not married, their wife is not of childbearing age. And let's put some more restrictions on there. If they're not gainfully employed, no Viagra for you. But see, we're getting into the, yep, this is not how we do this. We don't interrogate motives of individuals. We generally respect individual choice and freedoms. And the freedom to make healthcare decisions and to control our bodies is quite possibly one of the most fundamental freedoms of all freedoms. We haven't always been so good at that here in this country, have we? A country founded on slavery, which is, as a concept and in practice, the absolute other extreme end of demanding that we control our bodies and that we have autonomy over our bodies. In any case, thanks for that question and that text, Amy B. Really appreciate it. So important. Before we close out this hour, I wanted to share with you a little story coming out of Texas. You may have heard about a young man in Texas who has been suspended multiple times from a school in Texas because he has braids. He's an African-American student. He has basically dreadlocks that are then upbraided. And the superintendent of the school district, it's now, I believe, expelled him. He's suing the school district for a violation of the Crown Act. The superintendent of the school district published a full-page op-ed in the Houston Chronicle, except it's not actually an op-ed. It's a paid advertisement that, so the full-page ad was bought and paid for by this, the Education Foundation. I guess it's some private group of funders for this school. In any case, he trots out all kinds of stomach-churning. You know, it's sort of like, the thing sounds like it might be reasonable, but then when you think about it and you like play the tape back, it's really not reasonable. Here's a line. Let me find one of my favorite ones. Oh, here's one. The people who pay taxes in our school district are the voices that we will listen to. That's interesting. Does Moms for Liberty know about that one? Because they seem to go into all kinds of districts where they don't pay taxes and tell those districts how to run stuff. So, okay, maybe not that so much. He basically says the rest of Houston and all kinds of people were harming kids during COVID-19 by requiring school closures and mask wearing. He says then, we had traditional school during the entire pandemic, and our students, unlike the rest, most of the rest of the state, did not suffer educational setbacks. The data was clear from the beginning that COVID-19 did not affect children with the severity that it did adults. And the data was equally clear that students suffered irreparable harm by not being in a traditional classroom setting. He's saying those things to say, weren't we right because we didn't close school? That's what you call a logical fallacy. First of all, we didn't know exactly how COVID was going to impact kids. Secondly, there were adults in the schools that could very well contract COVID and die from it. So, you know, like that was also an issue. And three, yes, there were bad educational outcomes because kids weren't in classrooms. Frankly, there were bad outcomes for all of us because we weren't together with one another and we're a social species. But it was because people were dying. Doesn't make your decision right. Those two things, they're not causal. But here's the thing that really grinds my gears. So he's defending the fact that he kicked this kid out of their school because the guy has locks, which certainly sounds like racial discrimination to me. But here's the kicker in this entire page-long op-ed published by Greg Poole, superintendent of Barbers Hill, in the Houston Chronicle dated January 14th. He wrote this line: "The problem with relaxing standards without any regard to academic implication is the precedent it creates. Our military academies at West Point, Annapolis, Colorado Springs maintain a rigorous expectation of dress. They realize that being an American requires conformity." I kid you not. That's his argument for kicking a kid out because he's black and has locks. Because American means you conform. I ask you, Republican or Democratic, is that what it means? Because I think I missed that somewhere. It certainly does not. That's it for this edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. I'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. Keep it locked for Governor Evers' State of the State with Terry Bell and Todd Alba here on the Civic Media Radio Network.